of really extraordinarily tendentious media assaults on the church. Perhaps we want to talk about some of that in the discussion tomorrow night, because I do think it marks a kind of turning point in the interaction of faith and culture in the United States. But for the moment, let's put all of that aside. The word sex abuse will not exit my lips for the next 24 hours, at least. I want to talk about the enduring things of these two great pontificates. But let me begin by thanking all of you in this year of priests for all that you do for the people of God, for the church, for all of us. These have not been easy years in which to be priests. The mud thrown up by those very few who were unfaithful has stuck to the entire church, but particularly the priests. And that is, while that is grossly unfair, it's simply the way things are. And I hope you sense, as I sense in my own parish in suburban Washington, the enormous gratitude that the people of the church feel, faithful priests, and our determination to support you in your ministries as long as we are capable of doing so. So let me begin by thanking all of you in this year of priests for being the priests that you are. Now, let me begin with an unlikely citation. Who remembers Joanne Lai, former longtime foreign minister of the People's Republic of China, who 30-some years ago, maybe even 40 years ago now, was asked by someone, "What, sir, do you make of the French Revolution?" Which Joanne Lai thought for a moment and said, "It's too early to tell." Possibly the only wise thing Joanne Lai ever said. A useful caution, I think, in thinking too quickly and definitively about pontificates, particularly one as consequential as the 26 and a half years of John Paul II. But I'm going to violate the Joanne Lai principle and suggest that even now, as quickly as 5 years after the death of the Pope, 5 years after those remarkable few months that I'll reflect on with you later this evening, the months that I call in this new book his last encyclical, his last leading of the church in the world into the mystery of Jesus Christ crucified and risen through his own suffering and his own holy death. Even as quickly as 5 years after that, I think there are 10 accomplishments of John Paul II that we can identify now as having real legs, as having real endurance for the long haul in the life of the church and the world. The first of these had to do with the recasting of the papacy itself and a returning of the papacy to its evangelical roots. Some of you who are my age, late 50s, may remember back in the day, early 70s, a very interesting joint Lutheran-Catholic theological and biblical study called Peter and the New Testament, edited by Ray Brown and Harl Donfried and a couple of other folks of some consequence. If you go through that book, which is really quite worth doing still, you see many images of Peter emerging from the New Testament. There's Peter, the confessor of the Christhood of the Messiah. There is Peter, the betrayer. There is Peter, one of the first witnesses to the resurrection. There's Peter, the first great preacher of the church at that first Pentecost. There's Peter who brings Cornelius, the Gentile, into the church, thus allowing all of us to eat crab cakes, lobster, pork chops with a clean conscience. There is Peter, the center of the church's unity, at the so-called Council of Jerusalem in Acts, when the question of what do we do with these goyim, meaning, you know, you and me, that gets settled around Peter. And then, of course, as the tradition of the church tells us, there's Peter, the missionary bishop, first in Antioch, later in Rome. What there is not, in terms of images of Peter in the New Testament, is Peter as the CEO of a little up-and-coming enterprise called Catholic Church, Inc., which is seeking market share in the religious supermarket of the Mediterranean world during what we call the first century. And yet, by 1978, that is how most of the world, and indeed most of the church, thought of the papacy. The job of the pope is to manage the church, and specifically manage the central bureaucratic machinery of the Catholic Church. The pope as CEO. Karol Wojtyła, who had been a diocesan bishop for 20 years at the time of his election as pope, had never understood the episcopate as primarily a managerial job. And as he put it to me once over dinner, when I observed to him how struck I was by how much of his pontificate had been previewed by his time as Archbishop of Krakow. And he responded, well, if the Holy Spirit saw fit to bring the Archbishop of Krakow to Rome, it must mean that there was something in that experience of Krakow that was of use to the whole church. And I think part of what he brought with him was this idea of recovering the evangelical roots of the episcopal office, which for him, with particular reference to the office of Peter in the church, took their biblical foundation from Luke 22:32. And you, Peter, when you have been converted, you must turn and strengthen your brethren. John Paul II took that as a literal dominical instruction, not simply to Simon, son of John, fisherman of Capernaum, but to all of Peter's successors in the office that was founded upon Peter the Rock. And so John Paul II, for 26 and a half years, reformed, if you will, the papacy in the image of Peter, the evangelist, Peter the strengthener of the brethren, Peter whose unique task is to be that apostle who goes around to all of the people of the church, strengthening them in their commitment to Christ and challenging them to bring the Lord to others. This recasting of the papacy in this way was itself a powerful reminder to the world church that all true reform in the Catholic Church is a return to form. Reform means going back to form. And by form, I mean that constitution, in the British sense of the term, not the American written constitution sense of the term, that constitution, that fundamental structure that Christ bequeathed the church by raising up the kind of apostles and disciples he did. The impact of this recast evangelical papacy was remarkable in any number of ways. Perhaps the most striking of them was its impact on young people around the world. No one in 1978 imagined that the next pope, whoever he was going to be, was going to be a magnet for young people. And yet, John Paul II manifestly was that and has given a whole new vitality to the church because of that, to the point where his successor could say at his mass inaugurating his Petrine ministry in April 2005, the church is young. The church is young. This had a tremendous impact in Italy itself, this evangelical papacy. Italy, of course, is a country that, as those of us who have lived there for any length of time know, tends to wear its Catholicism somewhat lightly. except when you try to take the crucifixes out of the classrooms, and then everybody gets in an uproar. One of the measurable impacts of this evangelical papacy of John Paul II is in Catholic practice now. It is measurably up and stronger, and the Church is in a more vital position in Italian society and culture than it was before. I think we see traces of the impact of this recast, reformed evangelical papacy in John Paul II's commitment to the Divine Mercy devotion and his bringing that to the life of the Church. Here was something very specifically from Krakow that he thought was of global significance, because he understood that this was a world profoundly affected by its guilt over the horror it had made of the 20th century, and profoundly in need of mercy and forgiveness of God. This recast papacy even had impacts in the world of politics. If we look at John Paul II's extraordinary efforts to prevent the World Conference on Population and Development in Cairo in 1994 from adopting the idea of abortion as a fundamental human right on a par with religious freedom, freedom of association, freedom of the press, etc. It was this evangelical pope who could go around governments and over governments and appeal directly to the people of the world with a profound moral message, who turned that around, and who was, if slightly less successful, but still nonetheless somewhat successful the following year, at the World Conference on Women in Beijing, in again forestalling another attempt by the Clinton administration and its allies in the UN population bureaucracy from having abortion on demand lifted up as a fundamental human right. So this evangelical papacy had remarkable impact both within the Church and within the world. And we can see the present pope, in ways that I'll describe tomorrow, building on that in his first 5 years of office. So the first enduring accomplishment is to reform the papacy in this more dynamically evangelical mode. The second enduring accomplishment of John Paul II is what I think can fairly be called his rescue of the Second Vatican Council. 1978, one gang in the Church that thinks the Second Vatican Council marked a fundamental break with the Catholic past and wants to reinvent the Church de novo. Another gang is thinking this was all a terrible mistake. What on earth got into John the 23rd? Did he have indigestion? Who is this? You know, let's just try to get that behind us. Harold Wojtyla was a man of the Second Vatican Council. As the Second World War was the decisive influence on his personal, spiritual life, his cast of mind, his vocational discernment, the Second Vatican Council was the decisive decisive moment of his episcopal life, and set the program both for his time in Krakow and for his 26 and a half years as Bishop of Rome. His idea of the council was an interesting one, and came into focus very early. In fact, it came into focus 2 years before the council convened. Have any of you ever, in working on your degrees, worked with the acta of the Second Vatican Council, these huge folio volumes of all the speeches, all the documents, and whatnot? The first volumes of the acta, three or four of them, I think, are the responses that all of the bishops of the world sent in to a questionnaire from the so-called Anti-Preparatory Commission, the Preparatory Commission to prepare the Preparatory Commission, which was sent out in early 1960 to all the bishops of the world who were asked, Pope has had this interesting idea, we should get all of you guys together, what would you like to talk about? What do you think should be the agenda? And if you go through those acta volumes and read those responses, many of them are housekeeping. Evidently, a lot of bishops thought this is going to be a one-month, two-month deal. We'll go there, we'll approve documents that have been drawn up beforehand, so let's take care of the housekeeping details. A few tweaks of the liturgy, a few tweaks in canon law, a few adjustments of procedures between the Roman Curia and local bishops, and then we'll all be home by Christmas. One of the more interesting of those, I always tell people, is from the then Archbishop of Washington, Patrick J. O'Boyle, who sends in this laundry list of housekeeping details, like many other bishops, but apparently had a paratus or a theological advisor who thought you might look better if you put a big think question in there. So after his laundry list of canonical and liturgical tweaks that he wanted the council to address, he writes, "The council should pronounce, in light of the doctrines of creation and redemption, on the possibility of intelligent life on other planets." It's really cool in Latin, too. When I read that in an archive in Rome, I just burst out laughing, and my brain said, "What's so funny?" And I said, "Well, I've lived in Washington, D.C. for 15 years, and if I were the Archbishop of Washington, I would be much more interested in finding out whether there's intelligent life in my own diocese on other planets." Right. Exactly. Okay, so in the midst of all of these generally not terribly interesting submissions from the world episcopate, comes a letter from this kid auxiliary bishop of Krakow, Karol Wojtyla, who I'm sure nobody in Rome had thought of since he was named 2 years ago. And he does not send the laundry list. He sends a philosophical essay, which begins with the question, what the heck happened to the 20th century? Here's this century that began with all of these high hopes of a maturing humanity, tutored by science, coming to new heights of knowledge, technology, humaneness, etc. And what happens? Within 5 decades, we get 2 world wars, 3 totalitarian systems, a Cold War, the greatest persecution of the church in history, Auschwitz, the Gulag. It's a total mess. What happened? And then he suggests an answer. What happened is that the Western humanistic project, whose roots he saw, of course, in the classical and medieval world, had gone badly off the rails in early modernity to the point where it had produced distorted understandings of the human person that distorted and deadly and lethal politics were inevitable results. Therefore, he goes on to argue, what the council should do is rescue the idea of man. I trust I can use the M word. I'm going to use the P word. Rescue the idea of man, because it's the idea of man that has been so warped as to produce warped cultures, warped societies, warped politics, etc., etc. And the way to do that, he concludes, is to represent to the world Jesus Christ as both the face of the merciful Father turned towards us and the truth about our humanity. Jesus both reveals who the Father is and who we are. So the Christian rescue of Western humanism through a reconstitution of Christian humanism was, for Karol Wojtyla, the great project of the Second Vatican Council, which he tried to see through in many ways at the Council, particularly in his work on Gaudium et Spes, the pastoral constitution on the Church and the modern world. But that sense of the Council as a new Pentecost not only for the Church, but for a world careening off into deep, deep trouble, enlivened just about every facet of John Paul II's implementation of the Second Vatican Council. When I say he rescued the council, I mean not only that he found a way to understand and present the council that dealt with both of the unacceptable extreme positions, but more to the point that he provided authoritative keys for understanding the council, hermeneutic keys, if you will, for unpacking those 16 documents in an authentic way. Vatican II, as many ecclesiologists have pointed out, was a very odd council in that it itself provided no keys to its authentic interpretation. Nicaea provided a creed. Therefore, you know what Nicaea was up to. Council of Trent authorized the catechism, wrote canons, condemned heresies, etc. You know through those keys what the Council of Trent was about. Vatican II provided no keys. Simply provided 16 documents. But there was no creed, there were no anathemas, there were no canons, there were no dogmatic definitions. So there was a kind of hermeneutic free-for-all for 23 years. Then comes John Paul II, who provides systematically, primarily through the mechanism of the Synod of Bishops, and then his own post-synodal apostolic exhortations, a systematic set of keys to the authentic interpretation of Vatican II, whether we're talking about the priesthood, which many believe got short shrift at Vatican II, so we get pastores obligatus. Consecrated life, the laity, the lifting up in so many different ways of the great theme of Lumen Gentium, the universal call to holiness, and as, if you will, the ribbon that ties all of this together, the new evangelization. Phrase that John Paul II used for the first time, I think, in 1992. At least that's what the late, great Avery Dulles used to claim, and I'll go with Avery on that one. The new evangelization as the instantiation, if you will, the embodiment of this new Pentecost. Very interesting distinction that Cardinal Dulles pointed out in one of his own essays on all of this. Vatican I used the word gospel once and used it simply as a synonym for the four canonical gospel texts. Vatican II, on the other hand, uses the word the gospel 157 times and uses the words evangelization or evangelize 49 times. So the reconstitution of the Catholic Church as a community of evangelical dynamism for the world that badly needs to know the truth about God and the truth about us. I think that's the great hermeneutic of Vatican II that comes out of this pontificate and that really shaped everything in it down to the Pope's legislative accomplishments. It's rarely noted that John Paul II was one of the great papal legislators in history. Two huge codes of canon law, plus any number of apostolic constitutions, etc. And all of those intended to facilitate this new evangelization. Okay, third enduring accomplishment, John Paul II as the pivotal figure in the revolution of 1989, and the collapse of European communism. I had the honor to be the first person to put that argument into a book in 1992 with a volume called The Final Revolution, which was actually the occasion for my first extended conversation with John Paul II. And in 1992, the notion that the Pope was the pivotal figure in this drama of the 1980s was regarded as rather bizarre, because we all understood that it was Mr. Gorbachev who was responsible for all of it. Well, by the time John Paul II died, it was widely recognized by just about everybody that he was indeed the crucial personality of all this, not the only one. by any manner of means, but the crucial personality. And where that all began had come clearly into focus. It began in June 1979, specifically between June 2nd and June 10th, 1979, the 9 days of John Paul II on his first pilgrimage back to Poland, were days on which the history of the 20th century pivoted in a dramatic way, and he was the pivot on which that turn was made. This is now, as I say, widely recognized. The most distinguished historian of the Cold War in America, John Lewis Gaddis, and if I may mention this word in the presence of Father Landry, Yale University, writes in his new History of the Cold War, "The beginning of the end of European communism came at 10:20 a.m. on June 2nd, 1979. When John Paul II came down the gangway of that jet and kissed the ground of his native Poland." John Lewis Gaddis is not a Catholic. He has no dog in this fight. He's an honest historian who can see what was going on here. But what's important is to see how that happened. During those 9 days, with the exception of some very pro forma stuff at the beginning and the end, when he acknowledges the government and at the end thanks them for having him there, he pretended, he acted as if the government of Poland simply didn't exist. He didn't talk about politics, he didn't talk about economics, he didn't argue political theory, economic theory, legal theory. He gave back to the people of Poland their authentic culture, their authentic identity, and in giving them that, in returning that to them, which had been stolen, he gave them tools of resistance which communism simply could not meet or match. And he did that in a remarkable way by saying over the course of some 42 homilies, speeches, informal remarks, etc., "You are not who they say you are. Let me remind you who you really are." So a restoration of a people's culture gave that people tools of resistance of an irresistible sort. It took 10 years to work it out, not a little suffering, not a few deaths, including the martyr priest, Father Popiełuszko. But what the Pope did over the 1980s was demonstrate through his impact in Poland that culture is the most dynamic force in human history over the long haul. It's not politics, not economics, it's culture. What do people believe? What are they willing to stake their lives on? What are they willing to stake their children's lives on? And at the heart of culture is cult. Faith. Power of faith to change seemingly intractable circumstances was the demonstration that John Paul II gave beginning in June 1979 and continuing throughout the 1980s. This was very, very important in itself, obviously. I'm sure some of you have been to Poland. I've now spent close to 2.5 years of my life in Poland, all added up. It's a very different place today than it was when I went there right after the wall came down. And in many respects, that's a heartening change. The challenges are obvious, but to see a people who had lived in a gray world, you know, now live in a technical, is a very heartening thing, and the fact that their faith remains a vital and strong one is equally heartening. What did this do beyond what it did for Central and Eastern Europe? In terms of the broader sweep of modern history, it challenged the Marxist vocabulary of liberation. The notion, the word liberation had become a kind of wholly owned property of various forms of communism. He challenged that. He demonstrated that the atheistic humanism of European high culture analyzed by his friend Henri de Lubach, we're going to talk a bit about more tomorrow, was false. You didn't have to throw the God of the Bible over the side of history in order to have authentic human liberation. On the contrary, the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Jesus comes into history as a liberating force. And he restored the integrity and unity of Europe after two generations plus of artificial division. What the Europeans have made of that, which we'll talk about a bit tomorrow, is their problem, but he gave them a shot at being a unified and free and virtuous cultural entity. That's not a bad set of accomplishments, being kicked off by nine remarkable days in June 1975. Shortly after 1989, you may remember, there was a lot of fuss about, among the chattering classes at least, about are we at the end of history? Frank Fukuyama wrote this famous essay, The End of History, in which he argued that the triumph of democracy and the market meant that all the great questions of the human condition had been settled, and, you know, that's it. I mean, that's it. The life is going to be boring and dull and satisfying of consumer tastes and whatnot, but the great arguments are over. I told Frank at the time that I thought he had it wrong, that history was not simply politics and economics, and that there were undoubtedly going to be things that are coming down the pike that were going to attract all of our attention. 9/11 rather proved that point in a dramatic way. But it didn't take 9/11 for John Paul II to understand what was wrong. He very quickly saw in the early 1990s, and indeed I think you can roll this back to the late 1980s, even while the wall is still up, although shaking and crumbling, he quickly discerned a new set of threats to authentic human freedom in a notion of freedom as essentially choice, and choice that can attach itself legitimately to anything. Freedom is simply a function of the will. And that notion of freedom attached to a defective philosophy of man, anthropology, which understood the human person appropriately as simply a bundle of desires, And so John Paul II began in the encyclical Centesima Annus of 1991 to sketch an alternative vision of what he called the free and virtuous composed of three interlocking parts: a democratic political community, a free economy, but most importantly of all, a vibrant public moral culture, in which the truths about the human person, the moral truths built into the world and into us, truths we can know by reason, provide a kind of cultural template by which we can discipline culturally, legally, other ways, the enormous human energies that are set loose by free politics and free economics, which can careen off in any number of directions. Pope insisted that culture, vibrant public moral culture, was the key to the edifice of the free and virtuous society. It was not enough to simply get the machinery right, to design a well-functioning market economy, to design a political system with separation of powers, regular elections, legal protection of human rights, and then in both cases, all you have to do is put the key in the ignition and turn the machinery on, and it'll run just fine. He thought that was nonsense. It takes a special kind of people possessed of certain virtues, which they're capable of defending and transmitting to the future generations, to make the machinery of democracy and the market work so that what comes out is human nobility, not human degradation. So what comes out is human flourishing and not the reign of licentiousness. And it increasingly appears that he was enormously prescient in that sense, that the culture is the key to the working of freedom. So that will mark as the fourth enduring accomplishment in the Pontificate. The fifth, and again I would suggest that this one was another reflection of Karol Wojtyła, man of Vatican II, was to put the quest for Christian unity, the ecumenical imperative, at the heart of the Catholic Church. Now, this was, it has to be admitted, somewhat surprising for a Polish pope. There's not a lot of ecumenism in Poland because there aren't a lot of other people in Poland except Catholics. There's a famous story of Wojtyła in Krakow as Archbishop right after the council, wanting to get this ecumenical thing off the ground, and so he brings to Poland, because it's the first Polish diocese, the chair of Unity Octave, the week of prayer for Christian unity in January, and they invite the, I don't know, the one Methodist minister in town, the one Lutheran minister in town, an Orthodox priest or two, to the Dominican Priory, where there's an ecumenical prayer service, and then there is a dinner together in the monastic refectory. And according to the story, the prior is very nervous about all this, because they've never had these Protestants and Orthodox in the sacred precincts. So he wants to be hospitable, and he's nervous. And he wants to make a good impression on the Archbishop, but he's nervous. So when everybody sits down to dinner, he gets up and says, "You're all very welcome here. This is a most historic occasion. The Inquisition once met in this room, and now here we are." Whatever. That was ecumenical activity in Poland. It's interesting that the last thing Cardinal Wojtyła did before he left for the conclave that elected him Pope was to give permission for Billy Graham to preach in St. Anne's Collegiate Church in Krakow, right near the Jagiellonian University. And I remembered that when I was in got to Rome the day after John Paul II died, and went up to our platform on the Gianicolo above St. Peter's. And Billy Graham's daughter-in-law was coming down from the platform. You'd just been interviewed on the Today Show, I guess. And I had, on the flight over the night before, we had stopped in London, and I just scooped up all the newspapers I could grab off the stand and read them on the plane on the flight from London to Rome. And I had noticed that Billy Graham had said that John Paul II was the greatest Christian witness of the 20th century. And I said to the daughter-in-law, whose name I forget, Mrs. Graham, I said, "Please thank your father-in-law for me. I think that's extremely generous of him, given the fact that he's the only other plausible candidate for the title." And she said, "He really meant it." And I reminded her of this episode back in 1978, which she had forgotten. Okay, not a lot of ecumenical personal experience, and yet a deep commitment to quest for Christian unity, East and West, and then within the fractured church of the West. I believe it to be the case that in October 1978, when he was thinking, as all popes must think, within hours of their election,
now what? I really think he thought it possible to close that breach between Rome and Constantinople by the conclusion of the second millennium of Christian history, so that what had been a millennium of division, formally registered in 1054, although split widening for centuries before that, would be closed, and Peter and Andrew could walk across the threshold of the third millennium together. That was not to be, because of the incredible divisiveness within the Orthodox world itself, because of the obstreperous role played in that world by the Patriarchate of Moscow. But it wasn't for lack of trying that John Paul II tried to heal that breach, formalized in 1054. As for the intra-Western breach, there was an interesting juxtaposition of events in that President Obama. In the spring of 1995, those of you who know Rome know that there's an ecumenical center there called the Centro per Unione, down near the Gesù, actually. And it had invited Dr. Conrad Reiser, the General Secretary of the World Council of Churches, the embodiment of the old Protestant Orthodox ecumenism that had begun in the Edinburgh Missionary Conference in 1910, when the Protestant colonial powers essentially divided up Africa, who gets what here. Reiser comes to Rome, the embodiment of this 90-some-year effort at recomposing the unity of the church around a common creed, a common baptism, a common Eucharist, and a common ministry. And he announces, it's over. Just isn't going to happen. We've been trying this for 90 years. We're never going to agree. So let's just forget that. And by the way, that's not important anyway. Because what's really important is world peace and feeding poor people and saving the whales. And if it had been climate change at the time, he would have said climate change. I exaggerate only slightly. He threw the old ecumenical agenda of the unity of the church recomposed around creed and sacraments and ministry over the side in favor of a new ecumenical agenda of essentially European socialism. That this was the new ecumenical agenda. And that was the important stuff anyway. Because what does the world really care about creeds and sacraments? I don't know whether it was an accident, but it was certainly a delicious coincidence that a month later, John Paul II issued the first encyclical on ecumenism in the history of papal encyclicals, like Unum Sist, in which the entire thrust of the argument is that the only unity worth seeking is the unity in truth which Christ bequeathed to his church, which must mean unity in a common confession of faith, common understanding of sacraments, particularly baptism and the Eucharist, a common understanding of the church's ministry. This forthright defense of truth as the centerpiece of any Christian unity worthy of the name had interesting effects. It essentially ended the old ecumenism that was embodied by the World Council of Churches and those bilateral ecumenical dialogues with which the Catholic Church engaged with such enthusiasm after the Second Vatican Council, Anglican Catholic, Lutheran Catholic, Reformed Catholic, etc. I say it ended them because it put frankly on the table what the problem was. Namely, the partners of the liberal Protestant world had lost a secure grip on the truth of Christian faith. in part because they had lost a secure grip philosophically on the notion of truth. And we weren't really going to get anywhere as long as the image is often used, the goalposts keep being moved, because there is no fixed playing field. It's just constantly moving set of goals. On the other hand, and of course now we see the catch-up with Benedict's offer to Anglicans who can no longer abide the theological incoherence of the Church of England to find a home in the Catholic Church, etc., etc. That was perhaps predictable given the theological chaos of the liberal Protestant, or as we would call them in the United States, mainline churches. What was not predictable, and it was in fact quite fascinating, is that this emphasis on the truth, and specifically the truth as embodied in the person of Jesus Christ, created a whole new ecumenism with evangelical, Pentecostalist, and fundamentalist Protestants, who saw in John Paul II, the man their grandparents would have unblushingly called the Whore of Babylon, what Billy Graham saw, the premier Christian witness, premier Christian evangelist, of the 20th century. So John Paul II, by insisting on the old ecumenism, reconfigured the entire ecumenical dialogue in a dramatic way. And that's the ecumenism of the future, it seems to me. It's along this Catholic evangelical axis, not so much the Catholic mainline. Like Richard Newhouse used to say, mainline, old line, and about to be sideline. Protestant experience. We can get into the Orthodox situation tomorrow. We can talk about that. Okay, so that's number five. Ecumenism at the heart of the church, Catholic Church at the heart of the ecumenical enterprise, the ecumenical enterprise re-centered on truth. The sixth enduring accomplishment of this pontificate, and the one that was frequently noted at the time of the Pope's death, of course, has to do with his dramatic initiatives in the field of Jewish-Catholic relations and the tremendous response that drew from around the world Jewish community. There had been a lot of progress on this, of course, between Council and the election of John Paul II. Much of that had focused on what I would call civic decency. The eradication of vestiges of anti-Semitism in Western societies, the creation of public space in which everyone could feel comfortable and valued. John Paul II was all for that, but if you look at his address to the Synagogue of Rome in 1986, he raises the ante dramatically. He said, of course, we want decent, civil, tolerant societies. But is it not time, he says in so many words, to reconvene the theological conversation that was abruptly broken off when what became the Christian movement separated from what became Rabbinic Judaism about 70 AD at the time of the First Jewish War and the destruction of the Temple. Isn't it time to start talking with each other again about such basic notions as revelation, election, covenant, chosenness? What does it mean to be a light to the nations? What does it mean for those who claim Abraham as their father in faith, as we say in the Roman canon, and as Jews understand themselves, the children of Abraham? What does it mean for these two communities who share an Abrahamic passion and who share the Ten Commandments as a common moral code to be light to the nations? Now, in lots of parts of the Jewish world, of course, all you have to do is say theological conversation. All the alarm bells go off. Proselytism, badoop, 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 this is a threat. One place where that sometimes does not happen is here in the United States. Because here in the United States, you've got a jury that is secure enough to be able to take the risk of conversation, theological conversation. And it's not an accident that one of the great, perhaps the greatest response to John Paul II's initiatives towards Jews and Judaism came from Canadian and American rabbis, largely modern Orthodox and conservative. It was called Dabru Emet, and it was a series of propositions, one of which was that theological encounter between Jews and Christians is not a threat to Jewish identity or to the further decline of Jewish population. This created a huge furor within the Jewish world itself. But the marker had been put down by rabbis and religious authorities of impeccable Jewish standing. This is going to take a couple of hundred years to begin to work itself out in a serious way. You don't get over 1,900 years of trouble in a generation or two. But the fact that, as one rabbi friend of mine said after a long evening's conversation on the meaning of election, in which Christian and Jewish theologians were vigorously interacting. And my friend said to me, "You realize we haven't been talking to each other like this since the first century." That's because of John Paul II. And that's, I think, an enormous accomplishment and a potential source of hope. As with ecumenism, as with Jewish-Christian dialogue, in the seventh enduring accomplishment of John Paul II, which is to reconfigure the Church's conversation with science and the world religions, the other world religions, which I take to be essentially the same set of issues, dialogues in truth is once again the question. For John Paul II, tolerance did not mean ignoring difference. Tolerance means engaging difference within a bond of respect for the other's quest for the truth, in the calm confidence that all truths, from whatever source, literary, scientific, Islamic, Hindu, Buddhist, if it's really true, all of those truths point towards the one truth, cap T, who is the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. So we, knowing that, can engage in a calm, confident, non-agitated way with the truths as others have come to know them, the truths that others have come to know. This had an interesting impact in the world of science. Wojtyla was very interested in physics for most of his adult life. Among these clusters of young people that he began working with as a young priest was a group of rising young nuclear physicists in Poland. And he stayed in touch with these people literally to the end of his life. A lot of people have heard about the Castel Gandolfo Humanities seminars, and he would bring in philosophers and historians and political theorists and whatnot for a week-long gabfest at the papal summer residence. That was every other year. The years when the humanities people weren't there were the physics years, and he had this gang of physicists there every other year, up until I think 2002 was the last of those. And because of developments in the hard sciences, physics, chemistry, astronomy, etc., themselves, and I think because of clearing out some of the historical rubbish, Galileo, etc., making clear what had happened and what had not happened, and so forth and so on, a moment has arrived with hard science in which faith and those sciences can meet in a way that has not been possible in the past several hundred years. Because disciplines like physics, astrophysics, astronomy, etc., are bumping up into the limits of their own methodologies. They can't get at certain realities they know are there by the methods of their own science. There's a new openness there, and the Pope was eager to seize that. The difficulties, perhaps unexpected, in 1978, have come with the life sciences, biology, genetics, etc., medicines, and so forth. And we all know the issues on that front. As far as interreligious dialogue is concerned, I think the palpable respect of the Pope, of the late Pope, for the piety of Muslims created a foundation, set a stage on which his successor, and we'll talk about this more tomorrow, could sharpen that conversation by focusing on it, on the really serious problems that militant Islam poses for the rest of the world. But on those last three, ecumenism, Christians and Jews, science and world religions, I commend to you this thought of the calm confidence that the truth will prevail, because truth ultimately is an expression of God manifesting himself in the world. And if something is genuinely true, it will eventually lead us on a path to God. The eighth enduring accomplishment of John Paul II involves what has come to be called his theology of the body, of which Father Landry and perhaps others here have been major explicators in recent years. This was a huge surprise. If there was one thing the world seemed convinced of in 1978 about the Catholic Church, it was that the Catholic Church had nothing of interest to say in matters of human sexuality, in responding to the sexual revolution, etc., etc. In fact, the whole zeitgeist of the time was, why don't you guys catch up with the sexual revolution? Thus, among other things, celibacy, and so forth and so on. John Paul II did not believe that. And he did not believe that not simply as a philosopher and theologian. He didn't believe it as a pastor, because he had spent a great deal of his time, a great deal of his priesthood between 1946 and his appointment as auxiliary bishop in 1958, in working with young people and helping prepare them for lives as husbands, wives, parents, etc. He had been with his graduate students more than simply an intellectual mentor. He had been a spiritual director. He had been a counselor. And he thought that the truths that the church taught about human life and its proper expression and its role in both the procreation of children and in the bonding of husband and wife were true, but they needed restatement. They needed restatement in a more compelling way than the rather crisp scholastic terminology of Paul VI and Humanae Vitae. Wojtyla didn't doubt that Paul VI got it right in Humanae Vitae, but I think he had serious doubts about the way this had been presented. And was there another way to do this? So he comes to Rome in October 78 for the second surprise conclave of that year with the beginnings of a book he's going to write, a commentary on the first chapters of Genesis, with an eye towards recasting in a more biblically centered, more humanistically rich way, the church's sexual ethics. Well, much to his surprise, he's elected pope. But like a good intellectual, he doesn't throw material away. he thinks that this stuff is good enough for a book, it's good enough for papal audiences. So he begins in 1979 this sequence of, what is it, 128?
It's 129 unless you're Waldstein, who say now 134 with the lost.
We're dancing on the heads of pins here. 129, 128, or 134 general audience addresses built around the Genesis text on creation, built around the statement of Jesus in his polemic with the Sadducees, that they in heaven they are neither married nor given in marriage, Ephesians on the spousal relationship of Christ and the church. And he takes these three sets of biblical materials and weaves an entirely new and fresh approach to old truths in a way that has had, frankly, an astonishing impact. I rarely go to a college campus now, and I don't mean by any matter of means simply Catholic campuses, state universities, private schools. I was down at Baylor 2 weeks ago. There are study groups of young people reading John Paul II's Theology of the Body. Now, I mean, this at Baylor is really quite something. Maybe it explains why they got as far as they did in the This is really quite something. We also see the impact of this, I think, in marriage preparation programs, at least in some dioceses. In the broader sweep of the Catholic theological enterprise, I think it has restored the notion of sacramentality, the extraordinary that is revealed through the ordinary, to the center of Catholic theological consciousness, where it had begun, from which it had begun to drift. And it has demonstrated the hollowness of the, if I may be so bold, Catholic Theological Society of America, Boston College Theology Department, etc., approach to these problems, which simply repeat what's coming out of the culture anyway. I mean, you don't need the CTSA saying this stuff if MTV is saying this. I mean, you know, what's the point? This has been particularly important in getting a new conversation going between the church and feminists, who have begun to understand that the sexual revolution is a great deal for predatory and irresponsible men and a pretty bad deal for women. It has given us ways to approach the life issues that are quite distinctive from others. It has allowed us, as the Pope insisted in Evangelium Vitae, to say that the life issues are the new human rights, civil rights issues of our time. It's given us a purchase on the biotech revolution that is distinctive. None of this could have been predicted in 1978. Its long-term impact remains to be seen. It's a tough body of material to master. But Roger, I know, and others of you, because I have not mentioned, are doing this in your own pastoral work, and it seems to have an enormous impact and has given the church something to say again in a really dramatic way. Ninth enduring accomplishment of this pontificate is right in that bookcase, the Catechism of the Catholic Church. I have always found it interesting that at the end of 2,000 years of Christian history, only one Christian community thought it appropriate, necessary, useful, imperative to say to the world, we can still give an account 2,000 years later of who we are. Nobody else seemed to think it was important to do that. Nobody else seemed to think it was an urgent thing to say, this is what we believe, here's how we think we should live, this is how we pray and worship, here's how it fits together, and we're offering this to you. We're proposing this. We're not hitting you over the head with it. But you want to know who we are, what we think, how we pray, how we think we ought to live. Here it is. That's what the Catechism of the Church, Catholic Church, represents. It's many other things. It was a necessary break point in the catechetical madnesses of the post-Conciliation. It, frankly, was a populist instrument that gave frustrated lay people a way to say to Father Goofball, you know, what the hell are you doing here, etc. But in the broader sweep of Christian history, it was an enormously important thing to have done. We can still give an account. And it was an important thing, a crucial thing to have done at that moment in cultural history. Because as those of you who have to spend time in the fever swamps of contemporary intellectual life know, in both America and Europe today, the notion of a coherent, compelling, comprehensive account of anything is regarded as meshuggah, to use the proper theological term. Meshuggah. Crazy, yeah. Uh-huh. Father, that comes from a deprived cultural background. This is regarded as nonsense. Not only can you not put it all together, but there's no way you can be in touch with the knowledge of the past in any way that you can rely upon. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church says humbly, but forcefully, no. We think knowledge is coherent. We think you can put it together. We think we are in touch with the historical sources of our faith and our life. And here it is. Now make of it what you will, but here it is. We are taking our shot. Right. That was a terribly, terribly important thing to do. Important internally for the life of the church. Important culturally in this crazy postmodern world of incoherence, lack of connection to the past. There's your truth and my truth, but nothing we can call the truth. But do for this. And this catechism, in some sense, sums up the legacy of ideas in the pontificate of John Paul II, since the year 9B. How odd was it that 220-some years after Voltaire, in the name of reason, said that we have to crush the infamy being the Catholic Church and specifically the priesthood, because this was what stood in the path of the triumph of reason. Who's the last institutional actor standing on the global chessboard defending the capacity of human reason to get to the truth of this? The Catholic Church. Who's defending a noble view of the human person, not a degraded view of man as simply a bundle of itches that have to be scratched? It's the Catholic Church, and it's in the Catechism. This all goes back to what I was describing a moment ago, or actually many moments ago, as the rescue of the Western humanistic project by the Catholic Church under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, building a new Pentecost, a new evangelization for the third millennium and 21st century. Finally, 10th, the enduring accomplishment of John Paul II, I think, can only be measured in centuries in terms of the lives that he changed and how those lives affect other lives over time. I was telling Father Andrew and Father Martin and Father Vandersteen coming in today that I have had the great pleasure of becoming friends with the postulator for the beatification cause of John Paul II, a Polish canonist named Sławomir Ogut. And the first time we met several years ago, he took me into the mailroom at the beatification office, which is in a corner of the Vicariate of Rome next to St. John Latter. And he shows me the piles of letters in a variety of languages that are in one way or another simply addressed Pope John Paul II, heaven. And I said, you mean the guys who can't get my electric bill from one side of Bethesda, Maryland to another manage to get these things here? He said, well, here they are. That kind of inspiration can only be measured. Then, as all of you know, go to any seminary in the world today, and you see young men who, for whom John Paul II was the model of priesthood that attracted them. I'll talk about that a little bit more tonight. That's an enduring impact over time. The raising up of great witnesses to the faith from our moment in history, whether it's Faustina, or the martyrs of the Spanish Civil War, the martyrs of communism and Nazi persecution, or the martyrs of the Cristero uprising in Mexico, or Josephine Baquita, or any of the Gianna Beretta Mola, all of this extraordinary array of witnesses to the faith were the Pope offering to the church and the world an inspiration for the future. Caravaggio was very well read in the philosophy of history. But I think his deepest conviction about history was that changed lives change history. Changed lives change history. Converted lives change history. And I think that's the truth of his life. All of this was possible, these 10 enduring accomplishments, because he was a radically converted Christian disciple. That was the bottom of everything else. Beneath his priesthood, beneath his episcopacy, he was a radically converted Christian disciple for whom Jesus Christ truly was the answer to the question that is every human life. He believed that with every fiber of his being, and therefore he could invite others into an encounter with that same Christ. So, I'm sorry that this rattled on so long, but that'll at least give us something to chew on in addition to dinner.
At the end of the second talk tonight, we'll have a chance to ask questions about this talk as well as the second part of George's focus on JP2's enduring legacy. In a few minutes, we'll meet for evening prayer downstairs in the chapel, and then at 5:45, we have dinner, which is straight down this corridor here for those who have never been to Arnold Hall before. So downstairs in the chapel in a few minutes, if you can make your way down.